When Karen emailed me in April and asked me to be part of the panel on the sexual violence research 15 years after the Violence Against Women Act, I was in my office at the University of Cincinnati working with two graduate students. I shared Karen's invitation with them and told them about the NIJ annual conference. And as I was talking with them, two thoughts crossed my mind. My first thought went back to when I was a graduate student in political science at Northwestern University during the 1980s. I worked closely with Wesley Scogin. I recalled him telling me about invitations that he had received from NIJ to give presentations about victimization-related topics. And at the time, I thought, wow, this is what old professors must get to do, reflect on the progress made in the field. Now, Karen had just asked me to do what Wes had told me about when I was a graduate student, and I quickly thought that, well, maybe he wasn't so old back then, right? I mean, at the time, I was much younger, and I didn't have the perspective or experiences that I have now, more than two decades out of graduate school. Since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, I had grown older, okay, let's say more mature, into a full professor who had been working in the area of sexual victimization of women for a majority of my career. My second thought was a bit more quantitative. I realized that 15 years had passed since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. That time had gone by like a blink of an eye. It seemed like just yesterday, many of us here today were celebrating this major legislative accomplishment. I remember celebrating because the first time in my early career, federal funds were earmarked for the purpose of addressing violence against women. I also remember vowing that I would incorporate the 1994 passage of the Violence Against Women Act and its progress into all my victimology classes, all one that I teach, right? Because remember, I'm in a criminal justice department. And I wanted to do this so students would not forget the importance of this legislation and would come to realize and appreciate its positive effects on women's safety and well-being. Now, every time I teach a victimology class, my Violence Against Women Act lecture gets longer and longer as I add another year's worth of research and my commentary about the accomplishments of the Act. When I first started including this material in my lecture, I did not stop to think that there would come a time when most of my students did not know a time without the Violence Against Women Act. But that time is just around the corner. In just 2 years, 2012, those born in 1994 will enter college having never known life without the Violence Against Women Act. Let's now turn our attention to addressing the topic Karen asked me to address. Sexual violence research 15 years after the Violence Against Women Act, advances, so what's, and future direction. After some thought, I decided to ground my reflections in two topics that I consider to be major advances 15 years after the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. The first one is the publication and dissemination of sexual violence resources, and the second one is methodology, specifically the measurement of sexual violence. So I'm going to turn to the first topic, the publication and dissemination of sexual violence resources. When I first started researching the sexual victimization of women in the late 1980s, the reading list was quite short. There were only four must-read publications: Brown Miller's Against Our Will, Diana Russell's seminal study of rape among a large sample of women living in San Francisco in the early 1980s, of course, Mary Koss's pathbreaking national-level study of the sexual victimization of college women, and Eskridge's book, Real Rape, which was published in 1987. Each of these works reported that sexual victimization, in particular rape, was not a rare occurrence. Each also identified rape as a serious social problem that was not committed by a stranger jumping out of the bushes at night, as most females had been socialized to believe, but rather rape was committed by males women knew and trusted as intimate partners, dates, friends, or acquaintances. Collectively, these works not only laid the foundation of our current knowledge about sexual violence, but they also sparked lively debates and discussions about measuring the extent, correlates, and impacts of sexual violence against women, as well as, quote, what works in terms of prevention and intervention. This discourse included members of two communities. The first was scholars from a variety of disciplines who wanted to more fully understand the extent and nature of violence against women. The second was the community of service providers and advocates who wanted to promote the safety of these women and to be able to effectively address their needs. Both communities helped document the wide-reaching negative toll on women's lives, including their mental well-being, their physical health, and their economic sustainability. Research has also confirmed that professionals, therapists, and victim advocates who help women recover from rape experience vicarious trauma. Rebecca Campbell's work also has shown that those who study rape can become emotionally affected by investigating the devastating effects of rape. As evident at this conference, at this NIJ conference and the numerous other violence against women conferences that are held annually both in the United States and abroad, the passionate drive of these two communities is as much alive today as it was back in the 1980s and the early 1990s. Importantly, the collaboration between these two communities, at least my experience since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, has grown and matured over the course of the last 15 years. This is perhaps due to the increasing number of women who have enrolled in colleges and universities, especially those who are being educated in a range of disciplines that examine violence against women issues. Each community has grown separately to develop its own identity, but these two communities have also grown together because each has come to recognize and appreciate the complexity of sexual violence and the benefits of each other's efforts. We recognize that to effectively reduce violence against women, research needs to be translated into practices, and practices need to inform future research. Lessons learned from each community and their collaborations need to continue to be disseminated through a variety of means so that good research and practice remain well integrated throughout both communities. These two communities have also moved to develop a vocabulary to communicate effectively with each other. Having a vocabulary to describe and explain sexual violence has helped to facilitate public awareness and discussion on sexual violence, not only in general, but also in schools, among children and teens, and among employers and employees in workplaces. The fruits of researcher and practitioner relationships are quite apparent when looking at the amount of publications and web-based resources. Both communities have helped to facilitate the growth of the publication and the dissemination of sexual violence resources that are readily available and relatively cost-free to the public via electronic bibliographies such as the National Crime Victimization Reference Service or even Google Scholar. In preparing for this panel, I went to the NIJ homepage and found myself immersed for quite some time in the amount of information that they had organized under such titles as rape and sexual violence and violence against women. There is a plethora of written, video, and audio training materials available on the NIJ webpage, as well as lists of conferences, workshops, webinars, and forensic training for sexual assault. NIJ has certainly changed its appearance from its early web presence in the past 15 years. I don't know how much Violence Against Women Act monies went into producing and disseminating this information, but I can tell you it's well worth visiting the NIJ website to see what information they have to offer at a click of a mouse. The number of academic journals devoted to violence against women issues has grown from less than a handful of journals in the late 1980s that included JIPV and violence and victims to more than two or three dozen, including Feminist Criminology, which was launched in 2006. Much has changed in the last 15 years. Library shelves would groan over the weight of the numerous articles that are being published annually. Fortunately, these articles are now being stored electronically on servers that appear to have an infinite storage capacity. I must admit that it is challenging for me to keep up with all the latest published works that address issues concerning rape and other forms of sexual violence against women. In talking with others, I don't think I'm alone in this challenge. Carol Jordan's recently published results in violence against women indicate that the incidence of the keywords sexual assault, sexual violence, IPV, and stalking in five major bibliographic databases in the behavioral, biomedical, and legal disciplines have increased substantially over the course of the Violence Against Women Act. For example, the number of database hits for the keywords sexual violence and sexual assault each increased about 200% from 1997 to 2007. In light of her results, showing increased publication productivity and ease of access to these materials for many, not too surprisingly, I would predict that the sustained interest in violence against women issues will remain, and that the growth in the amount of information produced by researchers, practitioners, advocates, and their collaborations will also continue to grow. Thankfully, each year, I have a few graduate students who are interested in violence against women issues, and they help keep me abreast on the latest research results, programs, interventions in the field. I always remind my students that they should not solely focus their readings on criminal justice or psychology-based information. Rather, their readings about sexual violence against women need to expand to include a wide variety of disciplines. I credit the influence of the Violence Against Women Act and the collaborations among researchers and practitioners with helping expand interests in violence against women. My students, as well as I, now have to read materials from the fields of sociology, economics, law, social work, nursing, medicine, forensic science, pharmacy, epidemiology, and local and city planning to get a full appreciation of the depth and breadth of available information. When some of my mainstream criminal justice or criminology colleagues kid me about my research area, I remind them that they have a relatively easy job mastering one field of study. And if they want to be challenged theoretically, methodologically, and even ideologically, they should consider studying the sexual victimization in women and master the works produced by at least a half dozen disciplines that influence this area. Not too surprisingly, to date, none of my male colleagues have taken me up on my offer. Perhaps I need to take a different tact. Now I'm going to turn to the second topic I want to comment on today, measurement of sexual violence. Researcher-practitioner collaborations have helped to develop a greater appreciation by each community for the need of high-quality measurement to inform evidence-based policies and programs. We have come to realize that understanding the extent and impact of sexual violence is complex, as are estimating the effectiveness of prevention and intervention efforts. We need appropriate methods that can help us capture the complexity so we are able to speak with confidence about our results. Methods are fundamental not only to pursuing our interest in violence against women, but also to generating evidence-based knowledge that is respected and used both within and outside our respective fields. In the name of time, I'm only going to comment on measurement. Since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, there have been continued advances in the measurement of sexual victimization and perpetration. When I use the word measurement, I'm referring to quantitative measurement. Yes, all those countless columns and rows of numbers that are used to generate estimates of the prevalence and incidence of violence against women, as well as to estimate correlations and coefficients and standard errors of the predictors of violence against women, as well as the effects of programs. This type of measurement usually provides answers to how much questions about sexual violence. These numbers have been used to bring attention to the magnitude and the predictors of specific types of victimization, as was done in the National Violence Against Women Survey for forcible rape, physical violence, and stalking. Whenever I tell people I teach statistics, I can always tell the stats people from the not-so-stats people by their initial reaction. To ease the not-so-stats person's reaction, I usually point out David Border's words that, quote, "statistics are human beings with the tears wiped off," end quote. Hopefully these words give them an indication that there are stats people who also realize that there is a person behind each data point. I can assure you this is a constant message I make clear to all my students. Even though I try to give empirical estimates a human face, I am still very aware that quantitative measurement cannot answer all our questions. This is why I also use the term measurement to refer to qualitative measurement, narrative of women's experiences of sexual violence and how they cope with these experiences are also rich sources of information. Qualitative information can be particularly useful when answering the how and why questions about sexual violence. And it is these types of how and why and how much questions that have captured the attention of researchers, practitioners, and advocates alike, and questions that they have attempted to answer during the last 15 years of the Violence Against Women Act. Their complementary expertise has resulted in creative, mixed methodologies that have helped to push our envelope of knowledge and practice across the board, from basic research to service delivery to evaluations of programs. In looking over the definition and measurement category of NIJ's Compendium of Research on Violence Against Women, 15 grants are listed under the Violence and Victimization Research category. So let's see. That's only about one grant a year since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. Beyond the mere funding of these grants and the usefulness of the results to inform solutions, advances have also been made in measurement with respect to sexual victimization. Since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, NIJ has funded or co-funded three national-level studies of violence against women, including, as Becky pointed out, the National Violence Against Women Survey and the National Sexual Victimization of Women Study, and many smaller-scale ones that have generated lots of self-report survey data. The late Linda Salzman, a distinguished fellow and senior scientist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, was a good colleague to many. Throughout my career, she reinforced and reinvigorated my interest in the importance of good measurement of sexual victimization. She persistently worked on establishing uniform definitions of sexual violence. She and her colleagues recommended data elements for consistency in data collection. Influenced by these efforts, the CDC put together two compendiums of assessment tools, respectfully titled Measuring IPV Victimization and Perpetration and IPV and Sexual Victimization Assessment Instruments for Use in Healthcare Settings. Both compendiums represent the advancements in measurement that have been made since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. Many of these assessment tools are being used daily in healthcare settings to screen and assess for victimization and stalking, and researchers also routinely use them. Historically, Mary Koss's Sexual Experiences Survey has been one of the most widely used measures. It, too, has evolved from what we have learned since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. Koss and her dozen or so colleagues published a revised version of the SES in the late 2007. One primary change to the SES is the use of more behaviorally specific wording in the questions that provide descriptive cues with a scenario framework. As survey methodology research has shown, these types of questions make it more likely that the respondent will recall an event or understand that the event might be a victimization. Two other changes also highlight the advances made in the measurement of sexual victimization since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. First, researchers have well documented that not only are women at high risk of being re-victimized as adults if they were victims during childhood or adolescence, they have also shown that a substantial proportion of women will be repeatedly victimized during adulthood. And Koss's newly revised SES has taken this into account because she also has questions that ask about repeat victimization. I would also like to add that some of the research also shows that some of these screen questions, aren't enough, that we also need to take into account the value of incident reports, which provide us lots of information about what happened before, during, and after a specific incident. So they can inform us about the process of a victimization. Another example of an advancement in the measurement and categorization of rape is evident in two NIJ-funded studies, one by Chris Krebs and Chris Lindquist of Research Triangle Institute and their research team, of which I was a member, and the second one led by Dean Kilpatrick and his colleagues at USC. These two studies build on the role that alcohol and or drugs play in fostering sexual violence. They contribute to developing measures that can explicitly distinguish forcible rape, alcohol, drug-induced rape, and incapacitated rape. This is important because a growing number of researchers as well as prosecutors have begun to distinguish between different forms of rape. Being able to measure different forms of rape, estimate their extent, identify their unique predictors is yet another avenue for researchers and practitioners to continue to pursue. I'm just going to briefly go through the so what that Karen asked me to comment on. Why should measurement matter to both researchers and practitioners? A mathematics professor at Temple University summarized an answer to this question quite nicely in a New York Times Magazine article last month when he wrote, quote, "Unless we know how things are counted, we don't know if it is wise to count on those numbers," end quote. Continuing to improve upon the measurement of sexual victimization, its correlates, and its impact should not be overlooked, especially in the age of evidence-based programming, where translating research into practice and having practice-informed research should continue to be among the goals of the Violence Against Women Act as we head into the next 15 years. And I just want to, in closing, I'm going to have to briefly summarize. Looking at what has been counted and what relationships have been estimated, I think there's some promising news. Looking at both the UCR and the NCVS rape rates over the last 15 years, both sources report that rape rates have decreased during this time. Now, an important question to ask is, can this drop in rape rates be attributed to violence against women funding? I would direct your attention to Rachel Boba and David Lilly's 2009 article that was published in Violence Against Women, and their findings seem to suggest that there is evidence of a positive effect of Violence Against Women Act funding on reducing rape rates. In terms of future directions, as you might expect, I think given the marathon that we're in, because I don't consider this a sprint that lies ahead, it's definitely a marathon, I think we need continuation of the researcher-practitioner collaboration and the sharing and dissemination of sexual violence materials. I see an increase in sexual violence information. And also, I'd like to see more jointly funded projects in order to do what I call the big science. We know that we've had a lot of small-scale projects that have been done, but I think the time now is to do some big science and to do some replication in terms of these smaller scale studies to see if we can see replication across time and places. And, you know, all we have to do is be reminded of the Minnesota domestic violence experiment, and we well know that those results were not replicated. So I think the time is to do more jointly funded projects so that we can do some more big science. And last, let's also not forget that violence against women is not solely an issue, a U.S. issue. It is an international issue, and I want to just point your attention to the International Violence Against Women Act. It has bipartisan support. It's a bill that addresses for the first time violence against women and girls throughout all relevant U.S. foreign policy efforts, including international assistance programs. So once again, this legislation reminds us that violence against women is not just a U.S. issue or located in the United States. Violence against women and girls is a human rights violation occurring globally, and one that we should be mindful as we move forward in our responses to violence against women in the United States and abroad. Thank you.